Beep. As the hospital machines keep beeping, I slowly settle into the fact that my big news isn't going to wake Mom up. I wipe the tears from my eyes just as the boys come back up from the cafeteria. We don't say anything to one another. We don't need to. They sit around Mom's body and we all just stare at her. I glance at the clock. It's 2:30, 2 hours since we were told Mom has less than 48 to live. I wonder how much time she has left, where her lifetime falls within those 48 hours. Does she have 44 hours left? 10? 2? Every moment feels so slow and so heavy. I'm trying to hold on to each moment, but they just keep ticking on. I've never felt worse.
County die.
All of us whip our heads to Mom. What the fuck? She spoke. She feebly, barely, inaudibly spoke, but still, she spoke.
Camry die,
she says again. Marcus leans forward. No, Mom, don't say that. You're not going to die.
Camry die,
she says with a hint of anger. There she is. Dustin snaps his fingers. Canada dry. Mom's eyes widen with confirmation. We all crack up around her, harder than we would have if she wasn't dying. There's something about these life-or-death moments that just beg for some levity. They're too difficult otherwise, too excruciating. Marcus runs to the hallway to get a Canada Dry from a vending machine. He comes back, pops it open, and tilts it to Mom's mouth. We all share a smile. This is good, right? This is a good sign. Mom's speaking some version of words and slurping down Canada Dry. This means she's going to be okay. This means she's going to make it, right? I'm desperate. I know. I'm clinging. I know. But I'll cling if I have to. I can't let her go. Mom was moved out of the ICU wing a week and a half ago and has been in a regular wing since. So much for 48 hours. Take that, Dr. Weissman. That's what I think sometimes. Until he assures me and the boys, which he does often, that this does not mean she will have some sort of a miraculous recovery. He doesn't want us to get our hopes up. And as much as I wish I could argue with him, I know I can't. I see it. She shits in a bag and breathes from a machine. This isn't going to turn around. For the first week of her hospitalization, the boys and I stayed at a hotel nearby while we waited for her to die. But then she didn't. So after a week, we checked out of the hotel. Life resumed back to normal, or as normal as it could be. Dustin stopped taking sick days and went back to work. Marcus flew home to Jersey. Grandpa and Dad alternated work shifts so someone could be with Mom most nights, while Scott stayed with her during the days. I visited each day after I got off work on my spinoff, which had started taping. I'd go from slinging a butter sock and shouting my cheesy lines on the brightly colored, overlit Salmon Cat soundstage to sitting in a hospital bedside chair with outdated upholstery, surrounded by the smell of sanitation and the feel of death. Today is no different. I just finished shooting a scene where I confront some mean school bullies and slap somebody with a ham sandwich. And now I'm here, watching a nurse change my mother's shit bag while she side-eyes me. I know what's coming, and it is pure hell.
Are you?
The nurse asks. If this hadn't already happened 25 times in this hospital, I'd be shocked someone had the audacity to ask me if I'm Sam Puckett while I'm sitting across from my dying mother. I don't respond. I narrow my eyes and hope the nurse recognizes how inappropriate it is that she's asking this right now. She doesn't.
You look like Samantha Puckett. Sam, are you her?
I sit in this feeling of utter hopelessness toward the state of humanity while the nurse disposes of my mother's feces. No, I say, rudely.
You look just like her. Spitting image. Do you mind if I take a picture so I can show my niece? She's not going to believe how much you look like her.
I lean back in the chair. It squeaks. No, I'm not taking a picture. I look at Mom. It's wild how much cancer has changed her shape. She used to have curves, all 4'11" of her. She had thighs, a bit of an ass, and boobs, too. Well, boob if you're only counting real ones. The other one was the implant post-mastectomy. She had a small waist and narrow shoulders. She had shapeliness. Now her stomach is distended, her boobs have shriveled, her legs are twigs. Her arms look longer in an almost monkey-like way. They just dangle at her sides. She looks less human to me.
I love you,
Mom lobs into the abyss. This is one of the only phrases she has left in her. She has so many brain tumors that are so big in size that she's all but brain dead, and yet she still remembers how to sort of say, I love you. It makes my heart physically hurt.
I love you,
she says again, her head bobbing around and no connection behind her eyes. I bite my lip till it bleeds. I try looking at Mom while I'm here at the hospital with her. To savor her, to remember her. But at the same time, I don't want to remember her like this. So every time I look at her, within moments, I look away again. Sometimes I'll force myself to grab her hands and tell her I love her and that I'm here for her. But most of the time, I'm not strong enough to do that. So instead, I sit in the chair in the corner and I look at her occasionally. but otherwise I look out the window and try not to break down. My phone pings with a text from Colton. He's asking if I want to get away for a few days, take a road trip to San Francisco. He knows I'm struggling and thinks this will help take my mind off things. I check in with Grandpa that Mom's at a stable place for at least the next few days, and Grandpa says she is. I take one quick look at Mom while she spews some gibberish. I can't get out of this hospital fast enough. I get up, kiss her on the forehead, and leave. I'm sitting shotgun in Colton's Dodge Charger. He's driving. We're reminiscing about the first time we met on a movie shoot in Utah nearly 10 years ago. We're 15 miles from San Francisco when he suggests we pick up a little alcohol to drink back at the hotel. I've never had alcohol before, more so because I was scared of it after seeing Joe's relationship with it than because I'm holding on to any Mormon values or anything. But if there's anyone I'd try drinking with, it's Colton. He's warm and energetic and has a way of making everyone around him feel accepted. Plus, he's gay, so I don't have to worry about any sexual tension. We crack open the bottle the second we get to our hotel room and pour shots worth each into the two plastic courtesy cups from the bathroom. We open a packet of Sour Patch Kids so we can suck on them as soon as we take our shots. "You ready?" Colton asks excitedly. I nod. He counts us in. 1, 2, 3. We plug our noses, swallow our drinks, and suck on the Sour Patch Kids. "I don't feel anything," I say, confused. Colton agrees, so we take another shot. "Okay, still not much, but now I feel like it's slight dizziness." Colton agrees, so we take another shot. "Ooh, I think I'm starting to feel it." Colton agrees, so we take one more, just in case. Before we can determine how the fourth shot feels, we've jumped on the beds, played hide-and-seek in the hotel hallway, and snuck into the pool even though it's closed. We've planned a short film we're going to make together where we're handcuffed to each other for a week. We've tried to find handcuffs. Luckily, we haven't. The next morning, I wake up energized, mascara smudged all under my eyes like a raccoon, still wearing yesterday's outfit. "That was one of the best nights of my life," I declare. Colton agrees, and we debate taking another shot. Ultimately, we decide we'll wait until nighttime so we have something to look forward to. And my God, am I looking forward to it. I can't believe I've waited so long to get drunk. It's an incredible, one-of-a-kind feeling. When I'm drunk, all of my worries disappear. Hating my body, the shame I feel about my eating habits, coping with my dying mother, starring in a show I'm humiliated to be a part of, it all just goes away. When I'm drunk, I'm less anxious, less inhibited, less worried about what Mom would want or think of me. In fact, when I'm drunk, the voice of Mom judging me evaporates completely. I can't wait for tonight. 54. Knock, knock, knock. I jolt awake, startled by the noise. Ow, my head's throbbing. I rub my temples. This must be what it feels like to be hungover. I've only heard about what it feels like to be hungover, but I've never actually felt it for myself, despite the fact that I've gotten drunk almost every night for the past 3 weeks since having my first sip of Tennessee Honey Jack with Colton in San Francisco. Up until this point, every time I've gotten drunk, I've been able to wake up the next morning unscathed, regardless of what and how much I drank. But today's different, for whatever reason. Was it the tequila, the whiskey, the rum, the wine, mixing all four? Who knows? Knock, knock, knock. Shit, what time is it? I check my phone. 8:05 a.m. Fuck. I forgot to set my alarm. I was supposed to leave for a flight 5 minutes ago. This must be the driver that Nickelodeon sent. "I'm coming," I shout, trying but failing to put on my best "I definitely did not just wake up" voice. I yank open the front door. The suit and tie clad driver is nowhere to be found. Instead, it's Billy, my jovial contractor sucking on a cough drop, and his three crew members. "Hey!" Billy says cheerily as he bounds in, not waiting for an invitation. His guys trail behind. I totally forgot Billy was coming today. I shouldn't have forgotten, being that he comes almost every day. I bought a house 3 months ago. Everyone was telling me it would be a good investment. Plus, the idea was exciting to me. My first home. It would be free of must and mold and hoarding. It would represent how far I've come. I got a beautiful 3-story hillside house that was turnkey so I could move in immediately and not worry about having to do any remodeling. I even bought the display furniture so that I wouldn't have to think about decorating the place. My vision for this house was to not have any, to let someone else have the vision and let myself enjoy it. Within weeks of moving in, I learned the entire infrastructure needed to be dug out and replaced. A pipe broke and the shower leaked under the living room display furniture, ruining all of it. The kitchen sink and one of the toilets clogged. The deck chipped and a stair broke. This thing was not turnkey. This thing looked good on the surface, but underneath it was falling apart. As Billy and his guys barrel up the stairs, I step onto my porch and crane my neck over the ledge to see if the driver's down below. He is. Of course he fucking is. And not only is he, but he is, with his arms crossed and his gloves on and his car running and his trunk popped. Driver's level of preparation and timeliness has always been irritating to me.
I'll just be a few minutes, I shout down to him.
All right, ma'am, but we really should leave any minute. I slam the door in the middle of his sentence. I'm becoming an angry person with no tolerance for anyone. I'm aware of the shift and yet have no desire to change it. If anything, I want it. It's armor. It's easier to be angry than to feel the pain underneath it. I rush upstairs, drag the suitcase out of my closet, and open it up on my hardwood floor. The guys start banging and hammering in the bathroom to work on the shower while I crouch down and haphazardly stuff socks, underwear, pajamas, jeans, and shirts into my suitcase. I hold up a jacket, debating whether or not I'll need it for this trip. Is it cold right now in New York? I toss the jacket aside and opt for a hoodie instead. I shove it in my bag, shut the lid, and sit on it to try and get the zipper up. Shit, I forgot toiletries. I'm frantically jumping up to grab each respective item as it pops into my mind. It's chaos. I rummage through my bathroom cupboard and grab some makeup items, a travel toothbrush, a mini floss, and mouthwash. I toss them in the front flap of my suitcase when my phone starts buzzing. I swipe it open. Yeah, Dad? Hammer, 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 drill, drill, drill. You should get down here. Really? Hammer, 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 drill, drill, drill. Yeah. I throw my body onto my suitcase again. Why won't this thing shut? I yank the zipper harder. The part of it I yanked on breaks off in my hand. I chuck it. Are you sure? Because I'm supposed to leave for a flight right now. The car's downstairs waiting for me. I hear Dad take a breath on the other end of the phone. He sounds stressed. Where are you going? New York, remember? For what? Drill, drill, loudest drill I've ever fucking heard, drill. The Nickelodeon Worldwide Day of... I stop, realizing how ridiculous this sentence sounds. I don't know, some thing I'm supposed to be hosting, so I really shouldn't go. They say it'll happen today. I freeze, shocked for a beat, but not for long. I've experienced this moment many times before. Somebody says Mom's gonna die, and then she doesn't. I go back to tugging on the zipper. Yeah, but I start, knowing Dad will know what I mean. But what? Never mind, I always forget Dad never knows what I mean. But people have said this so many times before. This is just another false alarm. I really shouldn't head down. Nickelodeon's gonna be pissed if I bail on this thing. A beat. Knocking starts up again at my front door. The driver's probably checking in on me. Dad swallows. You really need to come down. Fine. I hang up just as I finally get the zipper shut. I'm sweating by this point. I stand up, cross over to my bed, and sit at the foot of it for just a moment to try and collect myself before heading down to see my mom for possibly the last time I ever will. I'm trying to process this intense reality, but I'm really struggling to because hammer, 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 drill, 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 knock, knock, knock. I'm sitting on the couch looking at Mom as she lies in the hospital bed that's been set up for her here in the living room of the old Garbage Grove hoarder house. The couch was removed to make enough space for it. Mom's been in hospice care for the past 3 weeks, so this is not an unusual sight, though she's typically sitting up instead of lying down like she is now, and her breath is shallower than I've ever heard it. Scotty and Dustin sit nearby. All of us are silent, the effect of years of emotional exhaustion. I'm surprised none of us are crying, but it's like we have no tears left. We've been through at least a dozen dress rehearsals of our mother's death. We remember the VHS tape. My phone pings with a text. Nickelodeon is reaching out to say no worries at all on me missing the worldwide day of whatever. I send a thank you text back. Another text comes through, this one from the guy I'm currently stringing along. Current guy and I met via Twitter. We arranged to meet up in person. I invited some friends so I wouldn't get murdered. Once I knew he was safe to be around, we went to fancy dinners and laser tag and mini golf. We even went to Disneyland together to watch the fireworks. I splurged on the VIP guide so we wouldn't stop any parades and piss off Goofy. Current guy is wonderfully sweet and thoughtful and romantic, but I don't love him. Maybe it's because I don't have space in my heart to love anyone right now while Mom's dying. Or maybe that's me trying to blame a genuine lack of connection on grief. Grief is a great scapegoat. Regardless, I'm discovering just how powerful of a tool it is to not love someone. Loving someone is vulnerable. It's sensitive. It's tender. And I get lost in them. If I love someone, I start to disappear. It's so much easier to just do googly eyes and fond memories and inside jokes for a few months, run the second things start to get real, than repeat the cycle with someone new. That's where I'm at right now with current guy. The distraction has been nice, but I'm ready for a replacement. I whip out my phone to check the text from him. What are you up to? Two spelled with two O's. I'm no stickler on spelling, but Jesus Christ, get your twos right. That's it. I'm ready to end things. I draft a text. Hey, I'm really sorry, but I just can't do this right now. My mom's gonna die, and I really need some time to just be alone. I hope you can understand. Send. Done. Simple as that. I look back up at my dying mother. A text pings. Don't say that, boo. Your mom's not gonna die. He ignores the rest of my message. I roll my eyes. I've told him 12 times that Mom's dying of cancer, but he acts like she has a sprained ankle. He has no concept of loss. I feel like the world is divided into two types of people. People who know loss and people who don't. And whenever I encounter someone who doesn't, I disregard them. I'm in a constant state of irritation these days. I just don't want to deal with people anymore. I set my phone face down on the arm of the couch. I look at Dustin, then Scott, then Mom. Her breathing looks so strenuous. She's struggling to hang on. I hate this. Mom takes a sharp breath in, then out. The hospice nurse locks eyes with Dad, gives a slight nod. Dad looks at us. Mom's gone. We're all numb. We don't cry. We just sit. In silence. Finally, I pick up my phone. 100 messages have poured in. Everyone's heard. E! News broke the story. How the fuck they already know, I have no idea. I go to my text tab, then click on the chain with current guy. I stare at his last text. Don't say that, boo. Your mom's not gonna die. I text him back. She just did. After. 56. We each say our goodbyes, which just involve us staring numbly at Mom's dead body. The nurse wheels Mom's hospital bed out and into the hospice van. Dad asks us what we should do and suggests we get out of the house, go somewhere. None of us respond. He pitches to South Coast Plaza, a luxury shopping mall about 20 minutes away. We pile into the car. I need an iPhone case, so we head into the Apple store. A small, upbeat employee with white teeth and a receding hairline approaches us. Well, hey there, how's your day going? He flashes a smile. We meet him with blank stares. Reading the room, Apple guy drops the smile and redirects. I appreciate this about him. Anything I can help you guys with today? I get my phone case and we're out of there in 5 minutes. We head to a small cafe on the same level for lunch. I order a salad, dressing on the side to make Mom proud. I don't eat a single bite of it. I feel lucky, grateful even, the trauma has finally resulted in my lack of hunger. Sure, Mom died, but at least I'm not eating. At least I feel thin and valuable and good about my body, my smallness. I look like a kid again. I'm determined to keep this up. I'm honoring Mom. That night, I get home to my big, lonely house. Billy and his guys left all their tools out since they're returning tomorrow. Tarps cover the living room furniture. I sit on one of the tarps and look around. I think I might hate this house. I fidget. The tarp crinkles and makes an annoyingly loud sound. I don't know what to do with myself. I open a bottle of whiskey and drink a few gulps straight from the bottle, then text Colton and a few other friends to see if they'll keep me company. We all head to Little Tokyo and sit down at a sushi place for dinner. I down a bottle of sake. The menus are passed around. I want everything. I want to eat all of it. I'm so confused. This past month, I haven't been able to even think about food. Every day, I've been living off whiskey, Coke Zeros, and 2 individual bags of barbecue baked Lays. What the fuck is happening? I'm starving, ravenous. I haven't been engaged in a single second of the 10-minute conversation. I'm sure everyone has mistaken my silence for grief, but this isn't grief. This is my secret food obsession. By the time the waitress comes around, I can't decide what to order, but I'm drunk enough that I just choose the first thing I see, the teriyaki bowl. I tell myself I'll just eat the steamed cabbage on the side, maybe a few bites of steamed rice, but by the time the piping hot bowl is placed in front of me, I can't hold back. I devour every bite as quickly as I can. I order another bottle of sake, another side of steamed rice, some egg rolls, and a bowl of ice cream for dessert. I drink the full bottle and eat every bite of the food. We get back to my place and my head is spinning from the alcohol. We play a board game and listen to music, but I'm just going through the motions. My mind is only on one thing, the amount of food I ate and what I'm going to do about it. I try and rush everyone out of my house as quickly as possible, which is a hard thing to do when you're the one who invited them on the day of your mother's death to keep you company. As each person leaves, they double-check that I don't need anyone to stay overnight with me. As soon as they're all gone, I race up my stairs and into my master bathroom. Billy's equipment is all sprawled out, so I tiptoe around the piles to get to the toilet. I lift the lid, crouch down onto my knees, and shove my fingers down my throat. Nothing. Fuck. I try again, harder. Ow. I poke my throat and taste a little blood. I must have scratched it raw. Oh well. I'm making this happen. I take a steady breath, shove my fingers back as far as I can, as hard as I can, and finally vomit spews up and out of my mouth, landing in the toilet. I look down at it, at the little chunks of rice and chicken and the frothy melted ice cream. I feel victorious. So what if I fucked up and ate? So what if I failed? So fucking what? All I have to do is shove my fingers down my throat and watch my mistake be undone. This is the start of something good. 57. I'm looking at myself in the mirror while I do my hair and makeup for Mom's service. I'm doing everything she liked best, which also happened to be the things that I like least. Hot curling my hair, overlining a bold red lip, and scraping eyeliner along my sensitive tear ducts. The end result is a bit more severe than I would have hoped, but I don't have time to redo it, so this will have to do. I pull on my black dress robotically, zip it up, and throw on a pair of heels. Marcus, who's been staying with me this week, drives. His wife Elizabeth sits shotgun. I'm in the back. I use the hour and a half ride down to make up my mind. It's a big decision, and it deserves a chunk of dedicated thought. The ride down is hell. Bumper-to-bumper traffic, and Sarah Bareilles' Brave is the biggest song on the radio right now, so it blares from the speakers every third song. On a regular day, Sarah's fine, but the last thing I want to hear on the day of my mother's funeral is how much Sarah Bareilles wants to see me be brave. I try to ignore it. I shut my eyes to focus, trying hard to find an answer. Am I, or am I not, going to sing Wind Beneath My Wings at Mom's funeral? During these last few months of Mom's life, her request has tormented me. I've been thinking about it constantly. I even practiced the song every night last month until my neighbor taped a piece of paper to my door that read, "No more Bette Midler." Due to some lingering Mormon beliefs, I think this means Mom will be looking down at me today, disappointed, from her throne in the celestial kingdom, the highest kingdom of heaven in the Mormon faith. No way Mom wound up in the terrestrial or telestial trash kingdoms. Gross. I'm whipped out of my train of thought when Sarah starts pulling out all the stops on that final chorus. You know what? Maybe she's right. Maybe I should be brave. Maybe I should sing Wind Beneath My Wings at Mom's funeral. For Christ's sake, literally, my afterlife depends on it. Marcus turns into the parking lot of the Garden Grove Sixth Ward of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the church we grew up in. We walk up the front steps and in through the back door. I haven't been here in years, but it looks and smells exactly how I remember it. Carpet cleaner and burlap, baby. White tiles in the entryway, blue carpet in the hallways, pictures of Christ in various settings with disciples plastered everywhere. Long hair on a guy does nothing for me, but the man does have a great jawline. Marcus and Elizabeth peel off to greet people, so I'm left alone. I head to the family waiting room and take a seat next to bleary-eyed Dustin, Scotty, and Grandma. I reach in my purse and pull out the Wind Beneath My Wings sheet music that I printed out last night, just in case. I thumb it and go over the words to make sure I have them memorized. I'm mentally singing it to myself, cringing when I get to the chorus. Shit. I know in my heart that I'm incapable of singing this song, but I feel like I have to. I can't break the last promise I made to my dying mother. I see the pianist walk by, and I'm about to hand her the sheet music, but just then the pallbearers show up to bring Mom's casket into the room. They are milking their moment. Pallbearers love the spotlight. My brothers are crying. Grandma's wailing. There aren't enough cold cuts. We underestimated the turnout. I'm the headliner of the eulogy lineup, so I have all the eulogies to sit through while I go back and forth on whether there's any way I can attempt the song. I would say I could bring the whole song down a step or two, but then the verses will be too low. I would say I could tweak the chorus melody, but let's be real, you don't tweak a Bette Midler melody. Bette knew what she was doing. It's my turn. I walk up to the podium. I'm shaking. Since I didn't give the sheet music to the pianist, my only option left to sing Wind Beneath My Wings at Mom's funeral is to just blurt it out a cappella. I clear my throat, take a deep breath, and then I just start crying. It's a guttural cry that puts my Hollywood Homicide audition to shame. I keep crying and crying until the bishop taps me on the shoulder. We only have the chapel for another 15 minutes. We have to prep for John Trader's baptism. I walk off stage. No Bette Midler. Thanks for being such a good sport, our assistant director tells me with a pitying, appreciative glance. Uh-huh. I say monotonously while two children bounce on me as we get ready to rehearse this scene for the seventh time so the kids can get their marks right. I've seen the creator fire children for little reasons, like if they lose a line or don't hit their mark. So on rehearsal days like today, our directors like to be extra sure the kids know what they're doing so that they don't lose their jobs. I hear that phrase a lot these days. Thanks for being such a good sport. I hear it on a daily basis. Not only from our assistant director, but from my managers every time I'm on the phone with them, from a writer or producer at least once a week, even from a network executive who sent me a $500 gift card to Barney's with that very phrase inscribed on the attached note. I know why I'm hearing this phrase so often. It's because my co-star Ariana Grande is a burgeoning pop star who misses work regularly to go sing at award shows, record new songs, and do press for her upcoming album while I stay back and angrily hold down the fort. I understand on a surface level why she has to miss work. But at the same time, I don't understand why she's allowed to. I booked two features during iCarly that I had to turn down because the iCarly team wouldn't write me out of episodes to go shoot them. I've tried to calm myself down by thinking the whole situation through. Okay, fine. Maybe they couldn't let me shoot the movies because they would have had to write me out of episodes completely, whereas for my co-star, they let her do her music obligations because she's just missing rehearsal days and parts of shoot days, but not entire weeks. Then this week happened. The week where I was told Ariana would not be here at all, and that they would write around her absence this episode by having her character be locked in a box. Are you kidding me? So I have to turn down movies while Ariana's off whistle-toning at the Billboard Music Awards? Fuck this. There was a time when I took the "thanks for being such a good sport" comment as a true compliment. I took pride in it. Mom always taught me to be one growing up, always wanted me to be one so I'd book more roles and build a good reputation to help my acting career grow. So when I was called one, I knew I was doing something right. Yep, I'm a good sport. I'm a good egg. I'm the good one, the one who's not difficult, the teacher's pet. But now, I'm over it. I've become a bitter person, and I'm resigned to that fact. I can't change my circumstances, so why try to change who I've become as a result of them? I'm done being a good sport. I resent being a good sport. If I wasn't such a good sport to begin with, I wouldn't be in this predicament in the first place. I wouldn't be on this shitty show saying these shitty lines on this shitty set with this shitty hairstyle. Maybe my life would be entirely different right now. I fantasize about it being different. But it's not different. It's this. This is what it is. Ariana misses work in pursuit of her music career, while I act with a box. I'm pissed about it. And I'm pissed at her. Jealous of her. For a few reasons. The first is that she had a much easier upbringing than I did. I grew up in Garbage Grove in a goddamn hoarder house with a cancerous mom who constantly wept about not being able to afford rent and utility bills. Ariana grew up in Boca Raton, Florida, an incredibly wealthy, idyllic town, with a healthy mom who could buy her whatever she wanted, whenever she wanted. Gucci bags, fancy vacations, Chanel outfits. I don't even want Chanel outfits. I don't like the way the fabric looks, and yet I'm jealous that she had them. The second is that when I initially got a development deal with Nickelodeon for my own show a few years ago, I thought it was going to be just that. My own show. This was supposed to be just Puckett, the harrowing tale of a brassy juvenile delinquent turned school counselor. Now it's some half-baked two-hander, Sam and Cat, about a brassy juvenile delinquent who, with her ditzy best friend, starts a babysitting company called Sam and Cat Super Rockin' Fun Time Babysitting Service. This is not harrowing. The third is that Ariana is at the stage in her career where she's popping up on every 30 under 30 list that exists. And I'm at the stage in my career where my team is excited that I'm the new face of Rebecca Bon Bon, a tween clothing line featuring a cat with her tongue sticking out, sold exclusively at Walmart. And I frequently make the mistake of comparing my career to Ariana's. I can't help it. I'm constantly in the same environment as her, and she doesn't exactly try to hide her successes. At first, I managed my jealousy well. When she came skipping on a set saying she'd be performing at the Billboard Awards, I didn't care. So what? She's pursuing a music career, a thing I quit doing because I hated it. And in her pursuit of that career, she's gonna go sing some cheesy pop song on a stage, a task that sounds truly awful to me. I was unfazed. Then she came trotting on a set saying she'd be on the cover of Elle magazine. That one got to me, but only out of my own insecurity. Am I not pretty enough to be on covers of magazines? Would I be the one on covers if this show wasn't a two-hander? Is she robbing me of opportunities that would have been mine? I stuffed down my jealousy and carried on. But what finally undid me was when Ariana came whistle-toning in with excitement because she had spent the previous evening playing charades at Tom Hanks' house. That was the moment I broke. I couldn't take it anymore. Music performances and magazine covers? Whatever, I'll get over it. But playing a family game at National Treasure, two-time Academy Award winner and six-time nominee Tom Hanks' house? I'm done. From that moment on, I didn't like her. I couldn't like her. Pop star success I could handle, but hanging out with Sheriff Woody, with Forrest fucking Gump? This has gone too far. So now, every time she misses work, it feels like a personal attack. Every time something exciting happens to her, I feel like she robbed me of having that experience myself. And every time someone calls me a good sport, all I feel is how much I don't want to be one. Fuck being a good sport. I'd rather be playing charades with Tom Hanks. Colton and I are chugging tequila pocket shots in the backseat of Liam's 2009 Toyota Corolla while he drives. The pocket shots are disgusting. We almost gag with each one down, but we keep on chugging. We want to be nice and obliterated by the time we arrive. How you guys doing? Liam coyly asks, wheeling around while he's at a stop sign. This is the fifth or sixth time he's asked it, and every time he looks right at me like I'm the only one whose answer he cares about. Liam and I met at Colton's friend's Cinco de Mayo party a couple months back. He was making himself some fajitas from the buffet table. 6'2", with a shaggy haircut and wide-set eyes, I beelined for him. We bonded over margaritas and our mutual attraction to each other. the stuff of substance. Couldn't be doing better, I slur as I split another pocket shot with Colton. God, I'm so fun. Good, good, Liam says with a wink. I've always been impressed by a man who can make a wink not creepy. He keeps driving. I haven't had sex yet, but it's starting to feel like an appropriate time. I'm not scared of it anymore. I'm not scared of anything anymore, because I don't really care about anything anymore since Mom died. Liam seems like a solid person to lose my virginity to. I like him just fine, but I don't care about him in a deep way, so I don't have to fear growing attached to him the second after we have sex, which is a genuine fear of mine since I've heard about this feminine weakness 100 times. I want to do anything to avoid it. I don't want to be some weak, smitten woman who falls for a man just because he was inside her. I want to be stronger than that. Liam and I are going to do it soon. I just know. Maybe tonight we'll kiss for the first time, and then maybe in a week or two we'll finally have sex, once enough tension is built up that we just have to break it. I'm excited as I fantasize about it. I chug another pocket shot. 20 minutes later, and we've arrived at the dance club where our friend Emmy is having her 21st birthday party. Colton and Liam help me hobble in since I'm so wasted and wearing such high heels that I'm not walking straight. We get inside and head to the bar. We order 3 drinks and guzzle them. The party itself is fine, a little boring even while inebriated. I see Emmy watching Liam out of the corner of her eye. I hate when females are so obvious with their crushes. If you're obvious, some other little bitch can come along and exploit that crush, use it against you, betray you with it. I learned this from Mom's long-winded speeches about trusting women even less than men. Men, they'll hurt you without ever really knowing you, she often told me. But women will know you deeply, intimately, and then hurt you. You tell me which is worse. And so I don't trust women. I just observe them. I watch them act desperate and weak and pathetic. It's so embarrassing to be a woman. I study women like Emmy so that I can be different from them. Better than them. I nurse another drink as I watch Emmy chat up Liam overanimatedly. And for too long. And with too many flirty blinks and hair tucks and inadvertent touchings of his arm. She's doing it all wrong. Poor thing. I do the opposite of Emmy and ignore Liam completely for the rest of the party. It's almost too easy. 2 hours later, we're back at my place. Liam dropped Colton off on the way home, so it's just the two of us. Liam throws me onto the bed and takes off my copper dress. I'm dizzy. The room is spinning. I'm wasted. I'm confused. Where the fuck am I? What's happening? I finally ask.
I'm having sex with you, Liam says in a tone that nauseates me.
It's halfway to a baby voice, the same inflection as what a baby voice would do, but without jumping up an octave. I kind of want to stop. This is not at all how I intended to lose my virginity. I never expected it would happen tonight. I thought tonight would be all about the magical first kiss, and the virginity thing could be done in a week or two. I thought I'd have time to mentally and emotionally prepare. But I also kind of want to keep going. Who cares about the rituals and preparation? If anything, I'm relieved to be getting my virginity over with. Fuck it. I say nothing. I squint my eyes to try and ground myself in some way so I can see straight. Finally, I do. Liam's holding my hips as he pumps into me repeatedly. A bead of sweat is trickling down his forehead. Gross. Liam eventually pulls out. He comes. I don't. The next morning, I wake up in a puddle of sweat. I feel suffocated, trapped, like I'm in a straitjacket. My eyes fly open. Liam is spooning me. He must have been spooning me all night with the amount I'm sweating. I try and break free, but I can't. A fucking giant is draped over me. That's the thing about being a small woman. Every man feels like a giant. I squirm. That doesn't work either. Finally, I start poking him until he wakes up. Then I pretend that I wasn't poking him and that he must have just felt something. He looks me deep in the eyes and smiles at me. Says that last night was amazing. I lie to him by agreeing. Figure I'll come up with a plan to ditch him later on when I'm alone. He tries to hug me more, but I tell him I really have to pee. I jump up to go to the bathroom and suddenly realize how incredibly sore I am. Walking hurts, so I waddle instead. I get to the bathroom and pull down my underwear to pee. There's some blood on them. I know it's not my period. I haven't gotten it for years because of my various eating disorders. It must just be from having sex for the first time. Peeing stings and burns, so I do it in little spurts, as if prolonging the pain will make it hurt any less. It doesn't. Finally, I'm done. I spend 10 minutes washing my hands, lathering them up, then washing them, then lathering them up and washing them again. I'm stalling. I don't want to go back in there with Liam. Something about his presence makes me uncomfortable. Knock, knock, knock. You all right in there? I tell him I'm not feeling well. He leaves. I postmates myself some breakfast. Eggs and bacon and toast and potatoes and a latte with whipped cream. I eat rapidly, desperately, until I'm halfway through. I can stop here. I'm full. I don't have to keep going. I can interrupt the cycle. I chuck the takeout box in the trash. Overwhelm floods my whole body. I rush to the bathroom, lift the toilet lid, and purge my breakfast.
I wash up. Usually I'm depleted by this point, but this time I'm not. I'm still filled with pent-up anxieties. I need to rid myself of these fucking feelings. I run back to the trash can and pull out the takeout box. I stuff my mouth with eggs and chew rapidly. Fuck, what am I doing? I need to stop. I spit out the half-chewed eggs into the trash can. I grab a perfume bottle from the bathroom and squirt some on the remaining food to guarantee that I won't eat any more of it. But then I eat more of it. The perfume makes me gag. I throw up. Sixty. You're looking great. You're really starting to blossom. You've never looked better, but I'd stop where you are. Any more and you'll start to look bad thin. Your body looks outstanding. These are all comments spoken to me over the past few weeks by producers, agents, and crew members that I work with. I have gotten more positive and creepy comments on my body over these past few weeks than I ever have before. I have over a decade's worth of eating disorder experience at this point. There were the anorexic years, the binge eating ones, and the current bulimic ones. The more experience I've got, the more I recognize that the body is hardly a reliable reflection of what's going on inside it. My body has fluctuated frequently and drastically throughout this decade, and no matter how it's fluctuated, no matter whether my body is a kid size 10 slim or an adult size 6, I've had an issue underneath it. People don't seem to get that unless they have a history with eating disorders. People seem to assign thin with good, heavy with bad, and too thin also with bad. There's such a small window of good. It's a window that I currently fall into, even though my habits are so far from good. I'm abusing my body every day. I'm miserable. I'm depleted. And yet the compliments keep pouring in. I've got to say, when you're doing run-throughs and you walk out the door for a scene, it's really hard for me to not focus on your ass. I hope it's not creepy that I said that. I meant it as a compliment. 61. It's Monday, my favorite day of the work week for two reasons. The first is that this is our shortest rehearsal day. The second is that every Monday, when we come in for the table read, we get an updated schedule dropped on the table in front of us so we can see episode titles, directors, and shoot dates for upcoming episodes. And each time that schedule is dropped in front of me, I get to see my name there on one of the episode titles as director. I signed on to do the spinoff mostly to placate Mom, but I also did it because the creator promised me this very thing, a position as director on one of the episodes. Sure, directing one of the creator's shows is not exactly the best way to flex your creative muscles, since the creator is ever-present during the shoot, adamant about his own ideas, and not very receptive to anyone else's. But getting to direct an episode of television is a chance to make the industry finally see me as something more than just a kid's TV actor. It's a way of showing that I have value outside the box I've been put in. I really want this. The dates of my directing job have been pushed a few times, but I've repeatedly been assured that this is just because of scheduling conflicts with other slated directors. I've also been assured that the newest dates that I've been given, dates for one of our final episodes, are locked. I'm set to direct. I grab my coffee, sit down in my chair, and watch as our production assistant drops the updated schedules in front of each person at the table. Come on, Bradley, let's pick up the pace here. Here you go, he says as he drops the salmon-colored sheet in front of me. I pick it up and look down toward the bottom of the page to the place where the final episodes are listed. The place where I should be seeing my name in one of those little directed-by boxes. But instead, I see two letters. N-A. It must be a typo. I look around to meet anybody else's eyes, but there are only a few crew members in here so far, and our ever-sewing wardrobe person isn't going to know a thing about this. My breathing gets weird and rapid. I look around for any of our producers who might know something about this, but none of them are in the room yet. I can't believe it. I feel like I just got the wind knocked out of me. Executives and producers start filing in. I lock eyes with one of them, the one I trust most out of these people I don't trust. We'll talk about it later, he mouths. No, I don't want to talk about it later. I want to sort through this now. What the fuck is happening? They can't possibly expect me to sit here and be a professional and do a table read when they've just taken away the one thing that I wanted out of this whole process. I fight back tears as I realize that I've been foolish. I believed that these people would do what they said they would, give me what they'd promised. Now that I've shown up to work every day, been a professional, swallowed my anger, and carried a show for almost 40 episodes, now that they've gotten what they wanted out of me, they're taking away the very reason why I was doing all those things in the first place. I feel betrayed. After the table read, I call my agents and managers, and they advise me to play ball, to be the good sport I've always been. But I'm so fucking tired of being a good sport. I don't know how much longer I can be one. It's Friday of the same week. A shoot day. It took an hour and a half for Patty, my makeup artist, but also one of my dear friends in this crew, to do my makeup because I couldn't stop crying. I'm a mess. I'm distraught.
I feel deceived and hurt and angry. I've told Patty what's going on, so she's even accompanied me a few times to various producers' offices as I try and garner a conversation with them, but each time I'm rejected. No one will speak with me. Everyone is tight-lipped. They're clearly all in this together, and not in a fun High School Musical clap-it-high kind of way. I pull on my costume sluggishly and head down to set. I haven't memorized my lines because I don't care anymore. I wish they would just fire me. This place is toxic and bad for my already poor mental health. I want out. I arrive to set for a scene in a boxing ring. One of my castmates plays a boxer who is managed by a 10-year-old. I thumb through my lines, silent. We start rolling. First take, I get through, barely. Second take, I get through, barely. Third take, I don't get through at all. In the middle of my second line, my breathing gets away from me and speeds up, like it does whenever a panic attack is coming on. Shit. I see stars. I'm afraid I'm going to pass out. Then I collapse on the floor. My chest heaves. Drool spills out of my mouth as the most hideous, intense cry of my life pours out of me. In front of everyone. The cast, the crew, the extras. Finally, one of my co-stars, the one who plays the boxer, picks me up and carries me off set. He takes me to my dressing room and sits with me. Patty joins. They comfort me and tell me they understand. They're here for me. Then someone knocks on the door. I'm immediately frozen with fear. Patty shouts that we'll be out in a minute. A booming voice from the other side demands to come in. I can tell it's one of our producers. Yeah, not now, Patty says rudely to the producer on the other side of the door. I love her. I appreciate her. She has the balls to stand up to these people. Can I just talk to Jeanette for a minute? I feel for her, the producer says. A part of me believes them, or at least wants to believe them. Another part of me is suspicious. I choose to believe them. I allow them in. They ask if we can speak privately. The others leave. They sit down on the couch opposite me. I like how you've decorated the place, they joke, since I've added absolutely nothing to this cold box of a dressing room. I don't laugh. They clear their throat. I'm assuming this is about your being removed from the director's slate. It's about a lot of things. A beat. They proceed. I want you to know that I vouched for you. I wanted you to direct. And there's somebody else here who doesn't want you to direct. Very badly, they don't want you to direct. So badly that they said they would quit the show if you did. And we can't afford that. So we had to remove you from the slate. I just want you to know that it's not your fault. I'm stunned. I have no words. The producer gets up and exits, shutting the door quietly behind them. Somebody didn't want me to direct, so much so that they said they'd quit the show if I did. I don't even understand how something like this is possible. I make myself throw up again and again and again. I don't know how else to deal with everything happening around me. I don't know how else to cope with so much of my life being so out of my control. I look around at the white walls. Maybe I should decorate the place. Prop master knocks on my door to deliver the butter sock for my next scene. I'm walking around Whole Foods buying groceries for the week. I'm coughing up the big bucks for my produce and frozen meals because I'm hopeful that if I spend an obscene amount for a bag's worth of food, I will be less likely to throw it up. By this point, I'm starting to realize that bulimia is not sustainable for me. My throat bleeds daily, my teeth feel softer, my cheeks look puffier, my stomach struggles to digest food, and I've gotten a handful of cavities since this started. I think I want to change, but so far, willpower has gotten me nowhere. Every morning I tell myself I'm not going to throw up today, and every morning by 10 a.m. I already have. Since willpower clearly hasn't worked, this Whole Foods thing is me trying a different strategy. I pull a frozen meatloaf meal from the shelf and inspect the nutrition label for calories and fat. 440 calories, 15 grams of fat. No way. I put that shit back. Another one of my brand new strategies is lowering my calorie intake like I did when I was a kid. I figure that if I keep my calories low, maybe the urge to throw up will go away and I'll be able to keep my food down. At least this is what I tell myself on the surface. But deep down, I know the truth. The truth is that I wish I had anorexia, not bulimia. I'm pining for anorexia. I've grown humiliated by bulimia, which I used to think of as the best of both worlds. Eat what you want, throw it all up, stay thin. But now it doesn't feel like the best of both worlds. It feels terrible. I'm filled with so much shame and anxiety every time after I eat, I literally don't know what to do to make myself feel better except throw up. And after I'm done, I have to. Half of me feels depleted, exhausted, like there's nothing left, which is helpful. The other half of me now has a splitting headache, a sore throat, vomit sliding down my arm and tangled in my hair, and even more shame on top of the initial shame, since now I've not only eaten, but thrown up, too. Bulimia is not the answer. Anorexia is. Anorexia is regal, in control, all-powerful. Bulimia is out of control, chaotic, pathetic, poor man's anorexia. I have friends with anorexia, and I can tell they pity me. I know they know because anyone with an eating disorder can tell when anyone else has an eating disorder. It's like a secret code you can't help but pick up on. Now that I've gotten my Whole Foods plan and my anorexia mission, I'm feeling motivation that I haven't felt since Mom died. Sure, most things are out of my control. Losing people I love, being on a show I'm ashamed of, directing jobs being pulled from me. But this I can control. I push my cart a bit farther down the aisle and pick up some black bean hamburger patties. 180 calories a patty and 5 grams of fat. I place this delicate angel of a food into my cart with great reverence since it is on my side, helping my mission. I push my cart forward. My phone starts ringing. Grandma. I've never much liked my grandma. As a toddler, I hated the way she stroked my back and ran her hands through my hair. It was like she didn't know how to touch from a nurturing, comforting place. She only knew how to touch from a seductive place. It disgusted me. When I was growing up, Grandma's favorite hobbies were gossiping on the phone and getting perms and complaining. Her feet hurt, her shirt's too tight, her perm's not the right color, Louise never called back, Grandpa's not home from work early enough, gas is too expensive, Sue Plantation took cornbread off the menu. It's not just that she's a bitter old woman dryly airing her grievances with a cigarette hanging out of her mouth, which would be funny at least. She's always teary-eyed, always wailing, always making her problems everybody else's. For all these reasons, I don't like or respect her. And I don't think she likes me much either, but she would never admit that because she's too busy crying about me not liking her. Since Mom died, I've tried to work on our relationship a bit. I'll try to text her back when I can, I'll call her every few days, and I'll send her an email once a week. There's way more maintenance to this relationship than I would like, and even so, it's not nearly enough for her, which I'm told every time we do talk. I'm emotionally spent, but I keep giving to this relationship because I don't want to be a dick and cut off my daughterless grandmother. I tuck my phone back in my pocket. I head down the aisle and find some frozen vegetables, pull out a bag and set it in my cart. My phone starts ringing again. Grandma. I text her. I'll call you in a minute. I tuck my phone back in my pocket, this time with some irritation, and head to the produce section. I grab a bag of Pink Lady apples, some carrot sticks, and a coconut that I'm not sure what to do with, but it looks nice, so why not? She calls again. I want to throw my phone. Instead, I answer it, leaving a hint of irritation in my delivery so Grandma can tell I'm annoyed. Grandma, can I call you when I'm home? I'm getting groceries. She's wailing. She says something, but it's indiscernible through the wails. I'm concerned. I ask if everything's all right. She keeps wailing. I ask again.
You never call me!
She finally gets out. Every time she calls wailing, I assume it's because Grandpa died. His health is rapidly declining. I know she knows I jumped to this conclusion because I've told her before. I've asked her if she can try to taper her screaming and crying. Every time I tell her this, she assures me she'll never do it again. She does it every time. I tell her sternly that I'll call her back when I get home, then hang up my phone. It starts ringing again. By now, it's not only me that's stressed, but the makeupless yogi with the hemp tunic who's shopping in front of me. I envy her glass skin. She eyes me. I'm embarrassed. Grandma calls again. I give up. I leave my grocery cart where it is and head out of the store. Glass skin looks pleased. I wonder if I should try microneedling. I cross the parking lot, and in the time since I've been in the store, a thunderstorm has started. One of the rare annual LA thunderstorms. Typically, I avoid driving in the rain because I don't like driving to begin with, let alone when there's rain involved. I get in my Mini Cooper, and just as I turn on the engine and my windshield wipers, she starts calling again. It's hooked up to Bluetooth, so her voice blares through the speakers. She's still wailing. Grandma, I say evenly, trying to calm her down. She's hysterical. She blubbers through some speech about me hanging up on her. I pull out of the parking lot and take a right, heading down the main street that leads to my house. Grandma, I say again, as evenly as I can, even though my face is growing hot with anger. I was getting groceries. We're on the phone now. Why'd you call? Her tears turn to venom immediately.
No need to get nasty with me, bitch.
My grandma frequently refers to me as bitch. She always throws a little extra salt on the word, too, for effect. Grandma, like I've said before, if you keep calling me names and guilting me every time we get on the phone, I'm gonna block you.
Don't threaten me, little girl.
I'm not threatening you, I'm telling you a fact.
I'm telling a fact, Grandma repeats, mocking my voice.
All my other grandkids call me way more than you do, Grandma complains. How are you?
How do you think I am, huh? Did you hear anything I've just said? You don't treat me well. Your mother must be rolling in her grave.
I wish I could just roll my eyes at this last thing she says, just write her off as an old batshit woman. But I can't. Mom stuff is my soft spot, the spot that can't be breached. I won't allow Mom to be used against me. And if she is, I take desperate measures. Okay, Grandma, I'm hanging up and I'm gonna block you.
Don't you dare! Your mother will weep tears up in heaven!
She always fucking does that. If she knows something hits me in a deep way, if she knows it hurts, she shoves the knife in deeper and twists it around.
How can a grandmother want to cause her grandchild pain? I know she's had a hard life, I know she's sad and desperate for attention, and I know she's hurt by my coldness toward her, but still, I do not think there are any excuses for her behavior. Bye! I hang up the phone. She calls repeatedly. I pull over, swipe my phone open, and push block. It feels good. It feels right. A surge of built-up stress leaves my body. I can breathe normally again. I get home and I walk up my front steps, slowly because of the rain. I get inside, my arms empty since I left Whole Foods in a huff. I was planning on starting my low-calorie anorexia meal plan tonight, but I'm too spent by now. The plan will have to wait. I order Postmates, bacon, Brussels sprouts, and French fries and beef skewers from a place up the street that I like. I pour myself a filled-to-the-brim glass of tequila to go with. I chug down the tequila before the Postmates even arrives. By the time it does, I'm famished. I devour it as quickly as possible. As soon as I'm done, I throw it all up. Fuck it. This works for me. Bulimia helps me. My grandma is blocked and my body is empty, and these are things that I need. 63. I've been going through the motions at work for weeks. I glance at my lines in the mornings, making no effort to memorize them for rehearsals. I completely tune out between breaks and for press. The back half of lunch break is typically crammed with interview after interview for all the teeny bopper magazines. Ever since the directing situation, I'm counting down the days until the show is over. 20 days left after today. Just 4 more episodes, and even still, I'm not entirely sure I'll be able to push through until then. I'm starting to expect I'll have a bulimia-induced heart attack. It's hard to admit it, but a part of me actually wishes I would. Then I wouldn't have to be here anymore. My thoughts have gotten dark and dramatic like this in recent weeks. And while at first I was aware of the shift and concerned, it no longer feels like a shift. It just feels like me. The disappointments in my life are piling up, and with each added disappointment, so grows my misery. Mom's death alone would have taken everything out of me, but since then, the pile has gotten bigger and bigger. I can't get a hold on my bulimia. It's taken me over and I've stopped fighting. What's the point? It's stronger than I'll ever be. It's easier not to fight it. It's easier to accept it. Embrace it, even. I've come to terms with the fact that I don't like acting. While I was able to push through the season for the promise of directing, now that that opportunity has been taken away from me, I feel that all I've ever been and all I ever will be is an actor. A has-been actor, because who's going to want to hire me when I've spent almost 10 years on Nickelodeon? How will I ever get a real acting job, anything out of this phony, bizarre sphere? I never went to college and have no real-life skills, so even if I wanted to get a profession outside of the entertainment industry, I'm years away from that being a realistic option. Men are not doing it for me either. They all just feel like distractions. And even so, I'd rather distract myself with a bottle of wine at night, or a full glass of straight whiskey, whatever's on hand. I'll even drink vodka, even though my body's started rejecting it by breaking out in puffy welts every time I have some. Doesn't matter to me. The buzz is worth the welts. I'm hopeless. And I can't help but carry that hopelessness with me. I walk slowly, my shoulders hunched. My eyelids are in a perpetual droop. I can't recall the last time I smiled unless it was for a scene. If I didn't know any better, I'd say my bad energy is what's rubbing off on everyone around me and bringing the onset vibe down to the miserable slump it's been in lately. But I do know better. I know the real reason. The creator has gotten in trouble from the network for accusations of his emotional abuse. I feel like it's been a long time coming and should have happened a lot sooner. I appreciate the amount of trouble he's gotten in. It wasn't just a slap on the wrist sort of thing. It's to the point where he's no longer allowed to be on set with any actors, which makes communication in between takes complicated. The creator sits in a small cave-like room off to the side of the soundstage, surrounded by piles of cold cuts, his favorite snack, and Kids' Choice Awards blimps, his most cherished life accomplishment. He watches our takes on 4 separate monitors, one for each camera, that are set up in his lair. Whenever he wants to give us a note, he tells it to an assistant director, who then has to run across the entire soundstage to give it to us. So our shoot days went from about 13 hours to about 17. The general onset vibe these days can best be described as malaise meets Dear God, Please, Let's Get This Over With. We're on the last scene of the day, one that takes place in one of our main sets, a robot-themed restaurant where all the waiters are, you guessed it, robots. My character is supposed to jump up on a table and tackle someone, or something. I don't know or care. The scenes, the actions, the lines, they all blur together at this point. I've done the stunt a few times. Between the stunt and the long hours and the bulimia, I'm spent. All I want to do is get home to some whiskey. Finally, just past 1 in the morning, we wrap. I get home, pour myself a full glass, and down half of it before showering off my false eyelashes, my caked-on foundation, and my hairspray stiff hair. By the time I'm out, the whiskey's kicked in. I'm bleary-eyed when I check my email. Messages pile in, half of which I won't even look at because I apply the same haphazard approach to my inbox folder as I do to everything else in my life these days. I'm about to X out of the window when I spot an ominous subject line hovering near the bottom of the unread email string, It's from my management company, saying we need to talk first thing in the morning. I click out of my email, top off my glass, and try to fall asleep. Sixty-four. The next morning, I'm on the phone with agents 1 through 3, managers 1 and 2, and attorneys 1 and 2. I don't remember when exactly the team got so big, and I'm still not sure why. I can't remember the last exciting idea anyone on this team had, and half the time they just echo what someone else on the conference call said, then laugh for too long. But apparently, this is what you do when you get successful in showbiz. Wait, they're canceling the show? I say, unable to hide my glee. Yep, we knew you'd be excited, agent number 1 says. Best part is, agent number 2 starts in, pausing for dramatic effect. I swear agents are the best performers. They're offering you $300,000. I pause. This doesn't sound right to me. Why? Manager number 2 chimes in. I can tell he feels intimidated by the rest of the men, so by the time he finally chimes in, whatever he says spills out rapidly as if he's been prepping himself to say it, working up the confidence while the others have been talking. "We'll think of it like a thank you gift," he blurts out in one mushed-together phrase. He lets out a sigh of relief after he spits it out, like he's done his part and now he doesn't have to speak again for the rest of the call. A thank you gift? I'm suspicious. Yeah, a thank you gift, manager number 1 repeats. They're giving you $300,000, and the only thing they want you to do is never talk publicly about your experience at Nickelodeon, specifically related to the creator. No, I say immediately and instinctively. A long pause. No? Agent number 3 finally asks. Hell no. It's free money, manager number 1 offers. No, it's not. This isn't free money. This feels to me like hush money. A strained silence. One of them clears their throat. Through the years, I've slowly learned that the entertainment business is one where what's being said is rarely what's being talked about. This way of operating not only disagrees with me, but seems genuinely impossible for me to adapt to. Everyone else seems so able to position things discreetly and choreograph their phrasing so that the heartbeat of what's being said is delicately danced around. But what winds up happening is that I usually just don't understand what's being talked about and have to ask outright. There are occasional times, however, where I do get exactly what's happening, like this time right now. And in these instances, instead of asking outright what's going on, I'll just say it. The results vary. Sometimes it's laughter, sometimes it's discomfort. This time it's discomfort. Well, I wouldn't think of it that way if I were you, manager number 1 says with a nervous laugh. That's what it is, though. I'm not taking hush money. Well, okay, if you're sure, agent number 1 or number 2 says, their voices are indiscernible. And with that, they all hang up. Click, click, click. Until I'm the only one left on the conference call line. I hang up too and sit on the edge of my bed. What the fuck? Nickelodeon is offering me $300,000 in hush money to not talk publicly about my experience on the show? My personal experience of the creator's abuse? This is a network with shows made for children. Shouldn't they have some sort of moral compass? Shouldn't they at least try to report to some sort of ethical standard? I lean back against the headboard of my bed and cross my legs out in front of me. I extend my arms behind my head and rest them there in a gesture of pride. Who else would have the moral strength? I just turned down $300,000. Wait. I just turned down $300,000. That's a lot of money. I've made a decent amount on this Sam and Cat spinoff, but definitely not enough that $300,000 doesn't make a difference. Shit. Maybe I should have taken it. 65. The show has been over for 3.5 weeks, and the story the press has run with is that it ended because I was upset that my co-star was getting paid more than me, which is upsetting to me because it's untrue. My manager told me it was